So you don't see a positive outcome, no matter what the answers are, do you?
I guess I hadn't really thought about it that way. But no, regardless of what power humankind has access to, I suppose I never see it as having a good outcome. We are animals after all. And don't let your house cat fool you into thinking that animals are nothing more than fuzzy, whiskered creatures who wish us no ill. Nature is bloody. And as a whole, it favors strength over compassion.
Chapter 17. We just passed City Hall, Sloane said to Esther, as the car pulled up to a curb again. This must be the Thompson Center. That big curved glass building? Esther gestured to the stone facade that confronted them. Doesn't look like it. I mean, I think the architecture is different, but we're in that location, Sloane frowned, so to speak. They passed through a dark, spacious lobby to an elevator bank. It was too dark for Sloane to see how high the ceiling was. Nero pulled a grate of tarnished bronze across the elevator doors before pressing the button. This building is in the Bygonist School, he said as the elevator rose. Which means it's made primarily without magical intervention, but represents styles of many periods combined without concern for accuracy. Without magical intervention, Matt repeated. Is that rare? To build something without magic? Nero shrugged. In Chicago, yes. Architecture is an industry heavily influenced by magic. And people here love their architecture. Cameron would have loved it, Sloane thought. The elevator came to a stop on the 7th floor. Nero led them to a balcony that overlooked a dome made of stone. The Hall of Summons, he explained, as if it were obvious what that meant. They walked to the back of the building and climbed a winding staircase made of wrought iron up another 2 flights to what appeared to be a wall of solid wood. Nero pressed his siphon-covered hand to the wood, then took it away, leaving a bright white handprint behind. It faded into the wall within seconds. And then the polished wood parted down the middle and opened to a long hallway with doors on either side. These rooms are occasionally used as apartments for important guests of the Cordis Center, Aelia said, gesturing toward one of the doors. She whistled. The door opened and slammed against the wall behind it with a shudder. They're intended to showcase the work of up-and-coming designers, so they are a bit odd. Nero set about opening the other doors with a gentler effort from his siphon. The Cordis Center, Matt repeated. Is that where we are now? Sloane walked the perimeter of the hallway, passing rooms in different styles. She took in only quick impressions of each. One done in Spartan simplicity. Another a Gothic cathedral in miniature with windows of stained glass. And the last full of delicately carved wood furniture. Yes, Aelia said. This building is primarily an academic institution, the Cordis Center for Advanced Magical Innovation and Learning. CAML, Nero said. CAML? Sloane frowned. C-A-M-I-L, Nero said. Or as the students fondly call it, the CAML. Aelia gave him a look and Nero shrank back. We will meet again tomorrow to further discuss things, she said. Please, try to rest. Nero, she jerked her head to the side. A word. Nero gave them all a nod and followed Aelia back down the hallway to the elevator. Sloane's instinct was to go after them and find a way to listen to their conversation. But the hallway went straight to the elevator, with no bends or curves or alcoves to hide an eavesdropper, so she stayed where she was. I call the church room, Esther said at once. Go for it, Matt said, glancing at Sloane. Surely he wouldn't want to share one. He turned and walked into the room filled with carved wood. Sloane's room, her only option, was white. White walls, white sheets, a wood floor painted white. But when she slid her fingers into the wide seams between wall panels, she discovered drawers, a small closet, and a hidden bookshelf. The last occupant had left a few books there. The Manifestation of Impossible Wants, A New Theory of Magic. A Society Divided, The Cold War Between Magic and Science. And The Mysterious Magical History of the Throat Siphon. Sloane was just weighing the last one in her palm when someone knocked. "Team meeting," Esther said. "My room." Sloane set the book down, leaving the white wall panel open. When she went next door, Esther was already sitting on the bed, her back against its elaborately carved headboard. Matt was tapping on one of the stained glass windows as if testing its stability. His face was dotted with multicolored lights in the shape of the Virgin Mary. Sloane leaned against the base of one of the flying buttresses. "So," Matt said. He looked weary. "Thoughts, anyone?" The request was a cue for her to tumble right back into the person she had been when they first fought the Dark One. She found herself speaking. "The overlap between our universe and this one seems to be substantial," she said. "I saw a lot of familiar buildings on the drive to the drain site. My guess is there's a relatively recent point of departure between this world and ours." Esther looked lost, so Matt explained. "There's a theory in quantum physics that there is an infinite number of possibilities for how any event might turn out. And each of those possibilities creates a different universe. Think of it like a fork in the road. You could go down either path, so there's a universe where you choose left, and another universe where you choose right. Slow's saying that the fork in the road for Genetrix and Earth happened pretty recently." "Is that good?" Esther asked. "I think so," Sloane said. "It means a lot of things will be familiar. Except, and I feel like this is a pretty crucial point that you're downplaying right now, we don't know how to get home," Esther said. "And they do. So we're trapped." "I'm not downplaying it," Sloane said. "I'm saying it's good that if we had to end up in a parallel universe, it's one where people speak English and aren't, like, growing a third nostril or sleeping in vats of goo or something." Esther snorted, and they all fell silent for a moment. "They were surprised by how many of us came out of that river," Sloane said. "They expected only one, a parallel chosen one." "Yeah. Could you have claimed that title any faster, Matt, by the way?" Esther said. Sloane crossed the room and opened one of the windows. A gust of cool air hit her face, making her shiver. Across the street was a building made of brown stone, with a row of columns set into it. City Hall. She heard the rush of cars across pavement and the roar of a distant train in motion. It sounded like the Chicago Sloane knew. When she turned back, Matt was shrugging. "Sloane getting pissed didn't seem to be helping, so I decided to be cooperative instead. Sorry for being a little startled that we got sucked into another dimension," Sloane snapped. "Startled?" Matt raised his eyebrows. "That's one word for it. Hostile is another." "Hey," Esther said, sounding tired. "We need a united front if we're going to get through this." She bit her lip. "Are we really going to do this?" Her stare was blank, fixed on the opposite wall or something beyond it. "Fight the Dark One again?" "We did it before." Matt's head was framed by the stained glass window, so it looked as if the Virgin Mary were gazing down at him, her eyes half closed, the very picture of serenity. "And we learned a lot from it. We can do it again. Better this time, maybe." "No," Sloane said. No, we won't be fucking better at it. Matt was ready with an objection. Slow. No, I'm not going to stand here and let you give us a pep talk when we're in a goddamn living nightmare, she said. Albie is dead. Inez is a universe away. The Dark One is still alive, and this world is stuffed with magic we don't know how to wield. I'd say you know something about how to wield it, Matt said coolly. How else could you have blown up the dome last night? Pipe bomb? Sloane didn't answer. She didn't know how. You think Sloane is the one who attacked the dome? Esther said. Matt. He's right. Sloane kept her eyes steady on Matt's as she spoke. I did it. I dug up Koshe's needle and destroyed the magic prototype. Fuck, Sloane, Esther said. I thought the needle was destroyed years ago. It wasn't, Sloane said. I just didn't want Eris to have it. But you thought it was fine if you had it, Matt said. Because you're more trustworthy than Eris. Yeah, she replied. I am. You probably killed people. You know that, Matt said. Janitors, security staff. Sloane looked down at the raised scar tissue on the back of her hand, the jagged lines caused by her crooked teeth. Wouldn't be the first time, she lifted her head. What? Matt said. Why do you think I gnawed the needle out of my own hand? Sloane brandished the back of her hand at Matt like it was a weapon. Because all the other people who were with me on the deep dive mission to get it are dead. I killed every last one of them. She was tense, her shoulders up by her ears, bracing herself for impact, she thought. Eris wouldn't remove the needle even when I begged them to, she said. So I did it myself. She remembered the X-ray of her hand taken after the deep dive incident. The bones, stark white against the black background, grayish in places where they weren't as dense. And then right in the middle, the thick needle, tapering to a sharp point. It's really stuck in there, the doctor had said. Like it thinks it belongs or something. Sloane had gone her entire life never getting what she wanted. No one had ever even asked her what she wanted. She didn't make any Christmas lists or birthday requests. That was a given. But there were also no signed field trip forms, no clubs or sports or musical instruments, no lunch money. Hell, no food in the kitchen half the time, especially after Cameron joined the fight against the Dark One. As far as her mom knew, Sloane had no desires beyond physical necessities. And sometimes she wasn't even allowed to want those. So when it came to getting the needle out, she had decided that this one time, she would get what she wanted for herself, even if she had to do it with her teeth. That was for your own safety, Matt said. Eris didn't know how the needle would react. Sloane laughed. Eris never gave a shit about our safety as long as at least one of us survived to fulfill the fucking prophecy. They made me keep the needle because it served their purposes. That's all. Matt's eyebrows knit together like they always did when he pitied someone. She hated it. And now here we are again, she said. Another wall of flesh between the people in charge and the Dark One. So how are we going to survive this time? Neither of the others answered. Esther seemed unwilling to even look at her. Sloane thought of the blood-stained waves crashing around the Eris boat, now empty. Thought of how she had hauled herself back onto the deck and padded on flippered feet to the controls to activate the distress signal, tasting copper on her tongue. She thought of the sting of water hitting her shins as she did a cannonball off the diving board. Cameron waiting for her at the edge of the pool. And the taste of river water. The pale glint of the Dark One's cheek in the moonlight before he disappeared. Sloane opened the door and was about to leave when Matt spoke again. "We'll find a way," he said. "Yeah," she replied, and walked out. Sloane wasn't surprised when Matt followed her into the hallway. Their first kiss had happened something like this. After the fall of the Dark One, he had asked her out a few times. Each time, she had refused. They were friends, she said. She didn't think of him that way. But it had just been an excuse, because she had no longer known how she thought of him. The image of him when she first met him, all elbows and knees, had vanished. And the one of him conquering the Dark One had replaced it. The light from the golden bough warm on his face. His arm taut and muscular as he held it out to cast the killing blow. His chest heaving, his jaw clenched. Her hero. Everyone's, really. But hers most of all. He hadn't accepted her refusals, which had bothered her. His persistence was just insulting, she insisted. As if he believed she didn't know her own mind. But in this particular case, he had been right. Because at one of Inez and Albie's parties, she and Matt had talked until 3 a.m, arms draped over the back of the sagging couch, beer bottles dangling in their fingers long after the beer was gone. Matt had asked her again, and she had avoided the question and gotten up to use the bathroom. And he had followed her into the hallway and kissed her. "Think of me another way," he had said as he pulled away. She couldn't remember that feeling of fire in her belly that had driven her to press him up against the wall next to the bathroom and push her tongue into his mouth. She didn't feel it anymore. "I know it's not a good time," Matt said, "but we have to talk." "I know." He was dressed in preppy funeral clothes, a white collared shirt, a tie, a black sweater, wool slacks, pressed so they'd had a sharp crease earlier that day. Now he looked rumpled and exhausted, like this conversation was just another task at the end of a long list. He said, "I'm not even sure where to start, honestly." Sloane laughed. It felt more like a cough. She didn't need him to start. As if drunkenly mocking Matt's proposal with Albie hadn't been enough. There was blowing up the dome, lying about the dive, hiding the FOIA request, burying the needle in their storage unit, and the line of little deceptions that made up their days, every time she felt one thing but said another, or indulged him in some fantasy of her that bore no resemblance to reality. There was almost nothing about them that was real anymore, and it was her fault. But her throat was tight at the thought of what was coming, because he would be another person who didn't want her. As if her parents, and Bert, and every journalist and chosen one fangirl in existence weren't enough. "You and I are all wrong," she said. "You don't need to convince me of that." "You're not even going to argue with me?" "There's no point." "So you have no desire to fight for us at all," he said, volume rising. "You've just, what, been waiting around for me to break up with you because you didn't have the guts to do it yourself?" She shook her head. "That's not it. I know that when you find something good, you should hang on to it. That's all." "That's so," he blinked rapidly. "That's so fucking selfish, Sloane." "What?" 10 years, he said. 10 years I could have spent with someone who actually gave a shit about me instead of someone who lies to me and can't even pretend to care when we break up. "I care," she said. "Just because I'm not the sobbing type doesn't mean I don't care." "If you cared, You wouldn't have bolted right after I proposed to you and made fun of me to Albie, he said. If you cared, you would have called a goddamn therapist after you almost sleep-murdered me in the middle of the night. I wasn't making fun of you to Albie, she said. He said it sounded like you didn't know me, and I agreed. That's all. Like I didn't know you. Yeah. Sloane threw up her hands. You're acting like all this shit comes as a surprise. Well, I am exactly who I've always claimed to be. And you've just been walking around with your fingers in your ears for 10 years. So in other words, it's my fault because I believed in you. No, it's your fault for acting like you know me better than I know myself. She realized, belatedly, that he had said believed. Past tense. She hadn't understood how much his belief in her, foolish as it had been, had permeated her until it was gone. She felt like a cored apple, gutted of all the things that could bring life or a future. All shiny skin and juicy flesh, and nothing else. She slipped the ring from her finger and held it out to him. Her hands were steady, but she couldn't meet his eyes. If she did, she would remember how warm they had been whenever they looked at her. How they sparkled a little when he smiled at one of her jokes. How fierce they could be when something threatened the ones he loved. She would be very little to him now. An old friend. An ex-girlfriend. She would fade into his memory. That was how it always was. She faded away for people once she had served her purpose. I really am sorry, she said quietly, for not being more. Yeah, Matt put the ring in his pocket. So am I. He closed the door behind him. Sloane sat at the end of the bed, listening to Esther thumping around in the room next door, and the cars rumbling past on the street below. A shush sound audible even from this high up. When she could move again, she crawled toward the headboard, her shoes still on, and curled up on her side. She could feel them coming, the wild, fierce sobs that took her over when the hollow feeling inside her was too much to bear. She grabbed the pillow and buried her face in it, falling asleep when she was too tired to feel anymore.
Top secret. Cordis, memorandum for the record. Subject, Project Delphi, Subproject 3.
1. Subproject 3 is being set up as a means to continue the present work in the field of divination verification and validation at until 4 April 1999. 2. This project will include a continuation of the study of the predictions of codename Sybil, with an aim to verify the accuracy the end-of-the-world prophecy made on 16 February 1999, as well as associated predictions from alternate sensitives, defined as those with an innate perception of times other than the present. A detailed proposal is attached. The principal investigators will continue to be and 3. The estimated budget of the project is $156,200. Will serve as a cover for this project and will furnish the above funds to as a philanthropic grant. 4. Are cleared through top secret and are aware of the true purpose of the project. Approved.
Top secret. Cordis, memorandum for the record. 2. Director, Central Intelligence Agency. From James Wong, Praetor of the Council of Cordis. Subject, Project Delphi, Subproject 3.
Dear Director, it is with a heavy heart that I write this report, knowing the implications of our findings. Let me get on with it. 1. Per your instructions, we investigated all 87 prophecies that had allegedly been made by codename Sybil, prior to the end of the world prophecy made on 16 February 1999. 2. We were able to verify that 80 of the 87 prophecies had indeed been made prior to 16 February 1999, according to witness testimonies, phone records, journal entries, and various other forms of physical evidence. We then pursued the results of said prophecies and were able to confirm that all 80 of said prophecies had indeed come to pass within a time frame ranging from 7 days to 13 years. 3. It is the opinion of the Council of Cordis that the fulfillment of 50 of these prophecies was both unambiguous and specific, i.e., that they are not predictions of the fortune teller variety, which are so vague as to be widely applicable. We defined specificity as details that apply to no more than 30% of the population. At least 5 of these specific details needed to be stated in the initial prophecy and met. 4. Therefore, we are forced to conclude that at the end of the world prophecy, being the most specific of Sybil's prophecies is overwhelmingly likely to be valid and imminent. The Council of Cordis therefore recommends that the search for the prophecy's chosen one must be undertaken with the greatest haste. I am sorry to be the bearer of bad news. I am available for further discussion or inquiry should you require it. Sincerely, James Wong, Praetor, Council of Cordis.
Chapter 18. Sloane dreamed that the Dark One was standing at her bedside, dragging a cool finger along her cheek. She woke with a start, grabbed the glass of water on her bedside table, and gulped it down. Few people had seen the Dark One's face without dying immediately afterward. Even his followers only saw something out of fantasy novels and space epics. A man of cloak and shroud, mask and mystery. So the startling thing about him, in Sloane's memories, was always his face. Young and pale. A swoop of mousy brown hair over his forehead. Watery eyes. He looked like the preserved corpse of a handsome man. His eyes empty. His skin waxy smooth. Sloane had seen his face and lived. She dove for the bag she had brought with her from Earth and turned it upside down on the white floor. It was morning, but only just. So the light coming from the frosted windows was blue. She squinted at the pile she had created. There were soggy receipts and gum wrappers, wet matches, a pocket knife, her wallet. She poked her fingers into the corners of the billfold. There, wedged between a dollar bill and the leather, was one last benzo. She held it up so she could stare at it. Just one left. She could take it now, trusting that this, the morning after finding out she was trapped in an alternate universe, was the worst it would get. Or she could save it for when she was insensible with terror. There were surely harder times ahead. Sighing, Sloane put the pill on the bedside table and stuck her head between her knees to breathe. It was a little brighter in the room when Sloane had collected herself enough to stand up. She left the wet matchbook and other scraps on the floor, shoved her feet into her boots, and walked down the hall. The others were still asleep. She went to the bathroom to force her tangled hair into a braid and rinse the sleep from her eyes. They hadn't given her a toothbrush, so either they didn't use toothbrushes anymore because they cleaned their teeth with siphons, or they had simply forgotten to leave her one. In any case, her teeth felt fuzzy. After making herself somewhat presentable, she walked to the elevator, but she didn't know how to summon it. The night before, Nero had done it with his siphon. But even magical elevators had to break down sometimes, she thought, so she went in search of stairs. She found them around the corner, through a door with a sign saying, "Emergency use only," which seemed more an idle threat than something to be concerned about. And sure enough, when she turned the handle, no alarm sounded. No lights flashed to warn of security guards coming. The stairwell didn't appear to get much use. The steps were decorated with black and white tiles in wedges and triangles. and the railings were wrought iron shaped into tight curlicues. She descended to the lobby, skimming the iron with her fingertips all the way down. She thought of her morning runs along the lake back in her Chicago. The cold air and the foam that gathered on the beach sand from the crashing of the waves. That, at least, would be the same on Genetrix. But when she reached the lobby, which was all marble, gold trim, and Art Deco diamonds, combined with Frank Lloyd Wright lines, she saw a sign pointing toward the library. The thought of an endless supply of information was irresistible. So she followed the arrow down a hallway of stained glass. The multicolored panes were arranged in a pattern of fanned half circles layered over each other, each segment a different shade of green. The rising sun cast green spots on her shoes. The hallway opened into a massive space that smelled like old paper. Sloane stopped and closed her eyes just for a moment, pretending she was home, in the library down the street from her apartment. Books smelled the same no matter what dimension you were in. The library was C-shaped, as if the room were curled around something to stay warm. Two stories of bookshelves towered over her head on either side of the somewhat narrow space, with walkways on the second level. In the center of the room were tables and desks, and the place was lit from above by skylights and by old-fashioned lamps with multicolored glass shades glowing in the center of each table. It didn't much resemble her library back home. For one thing, there were no computer banks crowding out the bookshelves. She frowned. She hadn't actually seen a computer in Genetrix yet, and the people she had seen in the passing cars the night before hadn't been staring at smartphones either. Did Genetrix even have the internet? Sloane walked along the inner curve of the library looking for a computer. The place was empty and silent. There was nothing keeping Sloane from running off with a stack of books. Nothing she could see, anyway. But then, she didn't know what Genetrix magic was capable of. "Can I help you find something?" She recognized the voice as Nero's, but jumped at the sound anyway. He emerged from the stacks on her left, his hands held up in a placating gesture. "I'm sorry," he said with a smile. He wore a pair of round glasses, and the cloak that had been fastened at his shoulders the night before was now loose like a cape. "I didn't know how to avoid startling you." She was glad she hadn't taken off her bra the night before. "Did you follow me here?" she asked. Nero raised an eyebrow. "Not exactly," he said. "You know, there are some dangerous places you could stumble across in this building if you wander unaccompanied. I myself am working on half a dozen volatile experiments at any given time in my workshop. But more frightening still for you would be coming across Aelia before she's had her third cup of coffee in the morning." "Well, thank goodness you just happened to come across me then," Sloane said flatly. "It's no coincidence," Nero said. "I made sure that I would be alerted if any of you began wandering. If your intention was to make us feel like we hadn't been kidnapped," Sloane replied, "that wasn't a great thing to share with me. I thought you might be more suspicious if I pretended to have simply happened upon you." "I would have been," Sloane smirked a little. "What tipped you off? The door to the stairwell?" "Not telling," Nero replied. The sun was climbing higher now, piercing right through the skylights above them. If she listened carefully, she could hear horns honking outside, morning traffic beginning. "Were you looking for something in particular?" Nero said. "When I was a student, I worked here, so I know my way around." "Maybe," Sloane sighed. "Do you guys have computers?" "Computers," Nero repeated. "Yes, we have them. But I'm not sure what good they would do you." "Oh, I don't know, the accessibility of information," Sloane said. "I'd like to know at what point our universes diverged. It'll be easier for us to acclimate if we know. This is a library, Nero said. Computers are for engineers and scientists. If history is what you want, this is where you'll find it. So does the internet exist? Esther was going to be so upset if it didn't. It exists, but I don't know anyone who uses it, Nero said. Why do you ask? At home, people carry the internet around in their pockets, Sloane said. Everything you could ever want to know, in any language, is right there. That's how I'm used to getting information. And you say you don't have magic. It's not magic, Sloane said. I know, Nero smiled a little. It wouldn't do us much good, I suppose. It's difficult enough to communicate about magical theory in written form. I can't fathom trying to share techniques your way. It's much simpler to gather in person. Sloane couldn't imagine something that couldn't be taught over the internet. The year before, she had learned how to replace a sink drain from a YouTube video. She had survived shopping for groceries in Germany by using an online translator. Even now, with her waterlogged phone back in the bedroom, she felt its phantom buzz in her back pocket, alerting her to an email or reminding her about a doctor's appointment. She had never had to explain to anyone why it might be useful. It was like having to explain why it was useful to drink water. Everything here seems backward to us, she said, like traveling back in time. You seem somewhat backward to us as well, Nero said. Let me show you. Tell me something you want to search for. Anything. Okay. She didn't know what to say at first. There were so many things they needed to know about Genetrix in order to find a way home. Even if they did it by defeating their resurrectionist, which Sloane still wasn't sure about. But she didn't want to ask Nero to look up something about magic. She didn't want Nero to be responsible for the information at all when she wasn't sure that she could trust him. So maybe she could look up something he had said, just to make sure he had been honest with them. You said there's a connection between this universe and ours, she said. I'd like to find some proof. I'm not sure you'll be able to do that here, Nero said. Our knowledge of the connection is rooted in analyses of magical energy fields, and Sloane wasn't paying attention. She was thinking of the footage Eris had shown them in the dome, the footage that was supposed to prove that the world was breaking, the trees hovering over the water, their origin unknown. The cornfield that had appeared on the ocean floor, and no missing persons report to match the farmer trapped in his tractor. If she assumed that Nero was correct about the connection between universes, maybe that farmer hadn't been from Earth, but from Genetrix. What's the date, day and year? She said. April 29th, 2020, he replied. Shit, Sloane said. It's only March back home. Time discrepancies seem to be common when traveling between universes, Nero said. We've found some ways to stabilize it, but we can only approximate. Sloane indulged in a moment of terror when she realized that even if they managed to get Nero and Aelia to send them back home, they might be thrust millennia into the future. Or worse, into the past. Then she pushed the thought aside. She couldn't worry about that now. I'm looking for a missing persons report from about a few months ago, I guess, our time, she said. An odd case. A farmer from somewhere in the Midwest. A corn farmer. Just disappeared while on his tractor. A John Deere, so probably American. Nero raised his eyebrows but didn't ask her anything. Instead, he put his whistle between his lips and turned toward the stacks. He raised a hand, then waved it carelessly as he let out a high, sweet note like the trill of a bird. Certain frequencies are like pathways for particular workings, he said, taking the whistle out of his mouth to speak. And there are a lot of categories for workings. But once you find the right pathway, intent is what guides the magic, not striking the right note. so I must know my heart's intent and be able to shape it. I want to find this for you, but I need a more specific intent. The missing tractor, I think, is more specific than your date range. He tucked the whistle between his lips and blew it again. A long, slow note. His eyes closed, and Sloane waited for something to happen. But when Nero opened his eyes and spat out the whistle, nothing in the library seemed to have changed. He smirked and gestured for her to follow him. He led her away from the towers of books and into a back room, where newspapers were stacked in neat piles on every surface. Most bore the name Chicago Post, which wasn't a newspaper Sloane was familiar with, although the New York Times made an appearance too. But what Sloane had first dismissed as reflected daylight was a glow coming from a few of the piles as particular newspapers lit up within them. She moved toward one of them, eyes wide and hands outstretched, and searched out the right issue from the layers that had dulled its brightness. She read headlines as she flipped through the papers. Resurrectionist sighted near Southside grocery store. New siphon regulations issued by European Union might cause problems for refugees. Birmingham, the next haven city. Airborne killer whale spotted near Alaskan coast. The glowing newspaper was the Peoria Chronicle. And on the front page was the headline, "Farmer in Iowa Goes Missing," along with half his crops. The text beneath it read, "Trevor Sherman, who owns a corn farm in central Iowa, disappeared while driving home in his tractor 1 week ago, as did an irrigation system and a square quarter mile of corn." The Chronicle's Midwest correspondent was able to verify this in person. Beneath the article was a half-page photo of a circle of bare dirt and half an irrigation pivot in the middle of a cornfield. Something had sliced cleanly through some of the remaining corn stalks, cutting them at a neat diagonal. The same was true of the metal irrigation pivot. Sloane said, "Before we came to Genetrix, we saw a report of a man and his tractor appearing on the ocean floor out of nowhere. I wondered if that man was from Genetrix. Looks like the answer is yes." "Not our first disappearance," Nero said. He tapped the newspaper she held. "Keep reading." Sloane skimmed past descriptions of the man's children, three of them, all teenagers, and the quotes from his wife to one of the later paragraphs. "Disappearances and reappearances of this nature have been occurring across the globe in recent months, including the incident on the Sunshine Coast in Australia just last year, in which a large iceberg appeared on the beach. Some magical theorists have proposed the multiverse theory as an explanation, but scientists reject this, as there has not been any concrete proof that any contact between multiverses is possible at this juncture, much less evidence that matter can be removed from one universe and inserted into another." Sloane looked up at Nero, who had been reading over her shoulder. "People here don't know that you figured out how to access another universe," she said. "It seemed prudent to be discreet until we understand the repercussions," Nero said. "We can't have just anyone trying to poke their way into another universe, after all." There was a section in the Peoria Chronicle called Magical Oddities. Most of the content sounded like something from the National Enquirer. People growing wings and tails, alien abduction stories, disappearing vehicles that later turned out to have been towed or stolen. But some of it more believable. A mailbox launching into the sky like a rocket. A cat clawing its way out of a grave. Another sighting of the resurrectionist, this time in Iowa. "So you're an I'll tell you only what you need to know kind of guy, then." Sloane set the newspaper down. Her fingers were gritty with ink. The light was beginning to fade from behind the headline letters, leaving her vision spotted. "How do I know you're telling me enough?" Nero sighed. "I know I owe you, all of you, an apology," he said. "It's inadequate, of course, but I can't emphasize enough how desperate we were after the Chosen One's defeat. It was like the world was ending. Sloane remembered the nights the five of them had thought the world was ending. There had been a few. The one after she and Albie returned from captivity was the worst of them. With Albie and Sloane in the hospital, and Matt pacing the hall between their rooms, unable to sleep. Esther's mother had been diagnosed with cancer just 2 days before. So they had wheeled Sloane into Albie's room, and everyone had gotten drunk. The feeling was what she remembered best. The exhaustion, but also the frantic need to escape. Like she was fighting her way out of a straitjacket. There had to be a way out, a weakness they hadn't discovered, an avenue they hadn't explored. They had never considered a parallel dimension. But if they had, she was sure that in her fevered state she would have kidnapped someone to save the world. "This resurrectionist," she said. "He's powerful?" Nero nodded. "Anyone can use a siphon and do something. But there's plenty of variation in skill levels. I say skill, but skill really has little to do with it. Talent is perhaps more accurate," he said. "Wrist siphons are the simplest. Throat siphons are expensive and require a natural affinity. The others suggest a high level of innate magical ability. Ear, eye, mouth, chest." He shrugged. "You can put one almost anywhere, though some are illegal because of the type of magic they produce." "Such as?" Well, placing one on the spine is said to render the wearer subject to another person's control," he said. "And placing one on the crotch causes horrific disfigurement." Sloane cringed. "People really will put anything down there, won't they?" Nero nodded sagely, but he was smiling. "In any case, siphons are difficult to master, and most people can't wear more than two at once or they will fall into a coma," he said. "The resurrectionist wears five." Sloane let out a low whistle. "His innate ability combined with his nature is catastrophic," Nero said darkly. "What do you know about his nature?" She spoke with care, sensing a shift in Nero's mood. Nero was quiet. The sun was high above the edge of the skylights now, spilling into the stacks and shining between the books. It reached them even in the back room where they stood among the newspapers. "My sister assisted the Chosen One," Nero said. "One night, she was taken, tortured, and her body was left hovering over this building. It took days to figure out how to get her down so I could bury her." Sloane remembered the day they brought her brother's body back from the drain site, in a government-issued casket. It hadn't fit in any room in the house, so they'd had put it in the garage for the night before the funeral. She had gone there after her mother was asleep, just to sit with him. She hadn't wanted him to be alone, as foolish as that was. She knew he wasn't there anymore. That whatever was inside that casket was just rotten flesh and bones. But she had stayed there all the same. No one ought to be alone in death. "I'm sorry," she said. "Her name was Claudia," Nero said. "As you have likely noticed, names from ancient Rome experienced a swell of popularity here about 40 years ago." "I wondered about that," she said. "Most people don't have positive associations with the name Nero." "My mother just liked the sound of it." His smile was small and forced a sharp crease into his cheek. "I don't like to discuss my sister, but I thought you should know why you were taken from your home. Or, specifically, why I assisted in taking you from your home." "Well," Sloane said, "thank you." "I think I should take you back to your room, don't you?" he said. "Or Aelia will have my head." "She seems a bit grumpy with you," She blames me for having summoned three of you instead of just one, Nero said. Though I wasn't the only one doing the working. What kind of siphon opens up another dimension? Sloane said. Guess, Nero said. Butt siphon, Sloane said immediately. Nero snorted. No, he said. It's actually not a body part at all. It requires multiple people standing around a massive siphon built into the floor, called a siphon fortis. There are some moderately large ones in Haven cities, but the only ones that boast this particular size are here, in the Hall of Summons, one in Los Angeles and one in Maine. Maine? Nero smiled. Our most prestigious magical university is in Maine, right on the coast. It's very nice there. Expensive, though. He checked his wrist, the one not covered by a siphon, to see the time. Let's go. I'm sure you'd like a shower and a change of clothes, and maybe breakfast. Together they walked to the elevator. They got back to the Chosen One's hallway just as Matt and Esther were waking up. Chicago Post. Nationwide Search for Chosen One Begins, by Lucia Arras. From the Archive, August 11th, 2009.
Chicago, August 11th. When word of a verified apocalyptic prophecy leaked to the press last month, fear and chaos ran rampant. But there was one ray of hope. Rumor of a Chosen One, who might be able to stop the prophecy's foretold doom in its tracks. Now an anonymous source inside the Council of Cordis, the government's magic branch, has revealed that the Council will be aggressively searching for this individual in the days to come. The criteria listed in the prophecy is quite specific, the source said. We'll be looking at a selection of children, mostly ones who have already displayed an advanced magical ability. Religious groups across the nation are divided regarding the doomsday prophecy, with some denouncing it as a false teaching or a heresy, and others declaring it to be a message from the divine. People dwelling in Haven cities, which prohibit the practice of magic, have begun protesting the government's perusal of their children's records for the purposes of finding and honing magical talent, citing privacy laws and the separation of church and state. The Council of Cordis declined to comment on this story and has not released an official statement on the matter of the Chosen One or the prophecy. In the past, however, the Council has acknowledged some unique expressions of magical ability in the population, including demonstrations of raw power, i.e., without a siphon, such as telekinesis, the creation of short-distance portals, mind reading, and divinatory gifts.
Top Secret. Cordis, Project Delphi, Subproject 17. Excerpt from the official log of Codename Merlin.
I will begin by stating that I am composing this report a week after the fact, upon verifying that subject Codename Mage is indeed the most likely subject of the Sybil Doomsday prophecy, who is the last hope of Genetrix, commonly referred to as the Chosen One. This will inevitably account for some bias in the retelling, as I am unable to separate myself from my current knowledge. However, I shall endeavor to be as objective as possible. My first impression of Mage came from his file, which I scanned prior to entering the examination room. There was a list of the usual facts. His name, age 10, hair color, eye color, birthplace. When I opened the door, he was sitting with his hands in his lap and his legs swinging. Average height for a 10-year-old, but somewhat scrawny, as if he had been mildly food-deprived, though it could have simply been his natural build. I experienced none of the signs that others have reported upon seeing our Chosen One for the first time. No tingling, no existential satisfaction, no blinding lights, choirs of angels, or impulses to prostrate myself before him. I find those reports to be ridiculous, as they elevate meeting mage to a religious experience, when it is, in fact, just encountering a child who has raw magical ability. "Hello," I said to the boy, and I sat across the table from him. Someone had brought him the magic development game Perception Interception. It can be programmed for a single player and had been for Mage. As far as I could tell, he hadn't used it or even touched it. He had instead been sitting in the examination room, unoccupied, for the better part of an hour. "You didn't want to play," I said. Mage shook his head. "All right," I said. "What have you been doing in here?" "Watching," he replied.
"Watching?"
"Yeah, the strings." He wiggled his fingers. "If I concentrate, I can see them."
"Strings," I repeated.
"What do they look like?"
"They're like when you see the sun through fog," he said, "in rays. Bright, a little hazy."
"And you've always been able to see them?"
Mage's eyes narrowed.
"You think I'm crazy, don't you?"
"I don't," I replied. "I think maybe you are describing an experience with magic that we simply haven't documented yet. Magic is new to us, and we are only just beginning to understand it. So I'm inclined to believe you."
"Oh." Mage brightened at that, but then, almost in the same moment, he deflated. "My mom and dad told me not to talk about it."
"I think your mom and dad were just trying to keep you safe," I said,
"because there are some people who get mad when they hear things they don't understand."
It was a shame, really, to see how readily he accepted that, to know how young we learn these lessons.
"Can you tell me more about what you see? How long have you been able to see them?"
He shifted in his seat.
"A long time?"
"Since I can remember," he said. "Not always, though, just when I try really hard."
"Well, that makes sense," I said. "When we talk about a work of magic, we often use the word intent, which is like having a goal or a purpose. Magic doesn't work without intent.
So when you concentrate on the strings, as you call them, your intention is to see them. Understand?"
"Yeah."
"Have you ever tried to touch one?"
He shrugged. "But even crafty children are not skilled at keeping secrets." It was clear to me that he had, in fact, experimented with his unique ability. And since one of the major criteria of Sybil's prophecy was that the chosen one would have a magical ability heretofore unseen on Genetrix, I needed to pursue it further.
"Will you show me?" I said.
Mage nodded.
He lowered his eyes, so he was no longer staring at me, but instead at the table. He drew a slow breath, in and out through his nose. It was clear to me that he had spent a great deal of his idle time doing this trick, because there was a process to it already, even though he was a mere 10 years old. In and out he breathed, steadily, until a kind of energy came into his eyes, like the answer to a tricky problem had just come to him. He reached out with his left hand and pinched. As to what happened after that, please refer to the video footage for a more complete understanding. Gravity failed, and everything in the room, myself included, began to float. The chair I had been sitting in bounced off the ceiling. I specifically remember one of the game pieces from Perception Interception, a glass eyeball, drifting past my face. But sitting in his chair below, as if nothing had changed, was the young man we came to know as the Chosen One.
Chapter 19. Shortly after Sloane returned from the library, a young woman named Cyrielle knocked on her door and introduced herself as Aelia's assistant. She was dressed head to toe in purple, the only exception the silver glint of her throat siphon, which Sloane now recognized as a status symbol. It was a simple cuff around the woman's neck with a string of purple beads at the back. Sloane spent the rest of the morning receiving deliveries from Cyrielle. Food, shampoo, soap, an old-fashioned straight razor, a pile of clothes, an assortment of shoes. By the time Sloane was dressed, in a high-necked black sweater with sleeves that stopped just above her wrist, and a pair of loose pants, also black, and fed, it was almost noon, and Cyrielle had gathered them all and was taking them to the Hall of Summons for what she called their orientation. Sloane took one look at Esther and groaned. As Sloane should have anticipated, Esther had taken to Genetrix's extravagant fashion immediately. She was swathed in layers of muted pink, cream, and beige. Her shoes, also beige, came to a sharp point. Her face had been restored to its former made-up glory, her skin dusted with powder, lips stained the color of wine, eyeliner winged to her temples. "All dressed up and no one to see it," Esther said with a sigh.
"We see it," Sloane pointed out.
"I meant Insta," Esther said. "You guys don't count." Matt walked beside Cyrielle, smiling and asking questions. He had not opted for the dramatic cape or voluminous cowl of the Genetrixae men they had seen the night before. But the jacket he wore was snug around his broad shoulders, and Cyrielle obviously approved, judging by the way her eyes lingered on him. He hadn't so much as looked